Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf. I'm your host, Ron Kaplan. Please visit us at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on baseball books and other media. Anytime a ball player comes out with a memoir these days, it's invariably compared with Ball 4 by our guest today, Jim Boughton. It's hard to believe that it's celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. I can clearly remember bringing my paperback edition to camp in 1970 and reading it during the moments when I wasn't on the ball field myself. For better or worse, Boughton has opened the door to a new type of writing that prior was unheard of. There were a couple of players who had written books during their career instead of waiting until they retired, but most of the biographies and autobiographies were based on heroics or adversity that the player had to overcome, and certainly not telling what was going on in the locker room, how players occasionally imbibed or treated their fans in a way that was considered almost un-American. And as can be expected, Boughton was not appreciated by most of his contemporaries at the time. Commissioner Bowie Kuhn said he had done a great disservice to the game, but in the grand scale of things, Boughton's book is undeniably, and as confirmed by the New York Public Library, one of the most important books of the 20th century. And I was very glad to have the opportunity to talk with Jim Boughton in preparation for a 40th anniversary celebration that's being held, sponsored by the Baseball Reliquary, on September 18th in California. For more information on that, visit baseballreliquary.org and also jimboughton.com. Hi, Jim Boughton, thanks for visiting with the Bookshelf today.
Glad to be here.
So, 41 years ago, when you were working on this, did you ever conceive that your writing project would be such a defining moment, not only of your life, but in sports literature in general?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I almost didn't do it. You know, when I told my dad, you know, they planned to keep notes and write everything down, you know, he said, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. He said, why would you risk, you know, your baseball career? You know, you're making $20,000. Why would you risk that to write a book? I mean, you know, you've never written a book before. You think that's a good idea?
So this was totally your idea then?
Well, actually, it was Leonard Schechter's idea to actually, you know, get it published. But when the Yankees sent me to, traded me to the Seattle Pilots for a bag of batting practice balls, the Pilots, this was 1968, the Pilots hadn't even formed their team yet, but they were starting to stockpile players in the minor leagues in anticipation of a draft, which is where they get most of their players. But I was available, and so they drafted me, and I played in the minor leagues in 1968, and boy, I thought to myself, if I'm ever going to write that book, because I had been thinking about it ever since I first started playing professional baseball, even in the minor leagues, what an interesting group of characters and what a lifestyle it was, and how funny and you know, amazing it was to be traveling around the country with these characters, that I would one day write a book about it. So when the Yankees finally sent me to the minor leagues, or traded me to Seattle and I got sent down to the minor leagues, I said, okay, this is the time if I'm going to write the book. Now is the time to do it. That fall, after that, after the summer in the minor leagues, I was having lunch with Leonard Schechter. He was writing a story about our adoption of a four-year-old Korean boy. And during the course of that lunch, Schechter suggested that might be a good idea for, why don't you write a book? I said, well, funny you should say that. I've been thinking of doing the same thing myself. As a matter of fact, I started keeping notes. So Schechter ended up helping me. He volunteered to be my editor, and he was able to get a book contract with World Publishing Company.
Now, Schechter at the time was working for the Times?
Schechter at the time was a sports editor at Look magazine.
Okay. And how closely did you work together?
Well, we worked very closely together in the final editing, but during the course of the summer, you know, I never saw him. I would take notes from the first day of spring training, and I would take notes all day long. I had a little notebook in my pocket, and when the notebook got filled up, then I would you know, grab whatever was handy. You know, popcorn boxes, hotel stationery, cocktail napkins, bar coasters, air sickness bags. I have notes written on everything. And I keep these notes every day, all day long. And at the end of the day, I would talk my notes into a tape recorder. And when the tape filled up, I would then mail it to a lady in New York City who transcribed it. And she would type out, remember typewriters?
Oh, yeah.
She would type out two carbon copies. So there was an original and two carbons. Len Schechter got one carbon, and I got one carbon. And we basically sort of looked at this material as the summer was going along. So I was able to sort of see what the book might look like. And I was, you know, crossing out stuff I didn't want in there and underlining stuff I did want. And Schechter was doing the same thing. We never spent any time together. We just talk on the phone once in a while. But when the summer was over and we sat down and compared our notes, we both agreed on practically everything. We had both underlined the same kinds of things, and we had crossed out, you know, stuff we didn't want, stuff that wasn't as good.
You mentioned not crossing out the stuff without naming any names. Was there ever anything, I mean, what kind of stuff did you decide that you didn't want to end up in the final version?
Mostly stuff that was boring.
Not stuff that was salacious and new.
No. Everything that was, I did have some ground rules. I understood that I was invading the players' rights to privacy, and that players were saying things in the clubhouse and in private that they never expected to see on a page. And so, out of respect for that, I never quoted any of the players making anti-Semitic remarks, racial comments. All the sexy stories are anonymous. I didn't put any players in bed with somebody they weren't supposed to be in bed with. So, you know, the notion that it was a tell-all book is just not, you know, not correct at all. It may be told a lot more than it had ever been told, but it certainly didn't tell everything.
Now, was there ever any point along the way where you or Leonard or the publisher said, "Gee, maybe this isn't such a good idea"?
No. As a matter of fact, I remember calling Schechter. This was after about 10 days of spring training, and I said, "Len, I said, what do you think? Do you think this is going to be good enough? Are we going to have a book?" He said, "We've got a whole book worth already right now. Keep going."
Now, your teammates are obviously aware that you were doing this. What kind of reaction did they have?
Well, you know, they were curious in the beginning, and you know, probably, you know, some of them were annoyed. I remember Fred Talbot once said during a meeting in the clubhouse, he said, "Hey, Boughton, no taking notes during a player representative meeting." Or another time, Talbot, who I thought was the funniest guy in the book, another time Talbot said to me, "You know, Boughton, keeping notes like that is worse than whispering." So it was, they all knew I was writing a book. They just, or writing something. They just figured I was probably going to write a regular sports book. You know, we had a tough ball game tonight, and I sure hope Lefty feels good because we really need to win tomorrow night's game. But no, it was not that kind of book.
Yeah, that sounds like in Bull Durham when Kevin Costner's teaching Tim Robbins to work on his cliches.
Right.
Now, the initial reaction among your fellow players after the book came out was kind, less than kind? I mean, I know you took a lot of heat from the Yankees.
Well, the problem was, and this could be a problem or, you know, or a benefit. Look magazine published some excerpts from the book in I think it was March. And of course, you know, the excerpts contained, you know, the most controversial information, you know, Mickey Mantle hitting a home run with a hangover, that sort of thing. But then the book itself didn't hit the bookstores until June. So you had between March and June, and everybody was basing their opinions about this book based upon the most controversial things that had appeared in the magazine. And of course, the first people to get angry about the book were the sports writers, because they felt that I had done an end run around them and that I had scooped them. And they were very angry to be scooped by a baseball player. And in fairness to them, you know, they didn't have the access I had. You know, sports writers do not, you know, they travel with the team, but they don't hang out in the bars. They don't, they're not in the dugouts. They're not in the bullpen. They're rarely in the locker room. So, you know, I had information and access that they didn't have. And so, you know, they were upset with that. And I was called all sorts of names, Judas, you know, Benedict Arnold, Dick Young in particular, a sports writer in New York for the Daily News, he was really angry. He wrote three or four consecutive columns about what a terrible thing this was. And he was particularly upset, I guess, because the title of his column in the Daily News was Clubhouse Confidential. So he was supposed to be getting the confidential stuff, not me.
But a couple of things. One, that was about the time where there was a new generation of sports writers coming on who weren't so deferential to the players as they had been, let's say, you know, going back to Babe Ruth's time, where, you know, the players could do no wrong, and anything they did outside of the game was kept outside of the game. And the other thing, you would think that because of the relationship of the sports writers with the players in the 60s and early 70s, they wouldn't want to do a book like this because it would make them into the Judas.
Yeah, then most sports writers don't want to really tell what really happens because, you know, they would lose their access.
Sure.
And most sports writers, except for the ones you just mentioned, but most sports writers considered themselves to be extensions of the team's public relations department.
Right.
Their job was to make the team look good, help the team win, and you know, they had a rooting interest in their team, except for, you know, the newer guys coming along. This was part of the whole revolution going on in the country at that time in the 1960s. There was a revolution going on in sports writing. You had young writers coming along, and they were more interested in writing about the players and who they were as opposed to just the score of the game and what the results are. People like Vic Siegel, the late Vic Siegel, Leonard Schechter, Steve Jacobson, Stan Isaacs. As a matter of fact, they were given a derisive nickname by, I think, Arthur Daly of the Daily News, New York Times. They were called the Chipmunks. Instead of watching the game, they would be, you know, chattering among themselves and not talking about baseball. One time in the press box, I think these sort of chipmunk writers that I spoke about were chattering around, and Jimmy Cannon from the New York Journal American said, "Baseball, gentlemen, baseball."